Hi everyone, James Gross here with an exciting announcement about our podcast moving forward. I'm very excited to welcome Ed Niedermeyer to the cast of characters who's been hosting this podcast over the many years. Ed is an American author and analyst covering all of the automobility space and mobility innovation. He does this, of course, with his books, as well as with the amazing podcast, The Autonocast. Moving forward for Micromobility and the Ride On Show, we really want to turn our focus to artificial intelligence as the next big unlock in mobility that, of course, will move small electric vehicles forward more than anything else. Ed is the perfect person to help lead us into this next frontier. And, of course, we'll still be joined with Ed by myself and Oliver Bruce and Horace Edu for shows and for co-hosting opportunities. But for now, we really want Ed to have the platform and to really start to define what Ride AI will mean and how artificial intelligence will change not just micromobility, but all of mobility. Today, in his first episode, he'll interview Mike Ramsey from Gartner about the idea of the slope of enlightenment, as we've kind of crashed out of a lot of the concerns that autonomous vehicles have had, and now we're entering a new phase where, of course, we're seeing increasing autonomous vehicles in all sorts of ways, whether it's for consumers or for more business applications. So please join me in welcoming Ed. I'm also very excited. Ed will talk a little bit about our conference coming up in the fall in the U.S. to correspond with Micromobility America. If you have any questions, of course, reach out. Thank you so much to everyone in the community that continues to push us, and we hope to continue to push you as we see a brighter future for all of us with technology and how we can move. With that, I'll hand it over to Ed and ride on.
Hello and welcome to the Ride AI podcast. I'm your host, Ed Niedermeyer. A lot of times when we talk about mobility technologies, we like to talk about hype and then the disillusionment that follows. And particularly when we think about some of the biggest mobility technologies over the last decade or so, we've really seen some of the highs of the peaks of hype and then some of the lows more recently of real disillusionment with some of these technologies. But that is not where the hype cycle that these terms come from ends. It is not just an oscillation between hype and disillusionment. Following the trough of disillusionment in the Gartner hype cycle that these terms come from is what's called the slope of enlightenment. And that is what I hope to cast a little bit of light on in today's episode, as well as in a lot of the content that is to come from both this podcast and ultimately our conference. So to help me understand what the slope of enlightenment is, how we get there, what it looks like, what it feels like, we have the perfect person to explain all this. From Gartner itself, the organization that gave us the hype cycle, Mike Ramsey is a longtime, he's an automotive journalist. When I first got started, he was one of the leading automotive journalists. He's now the VP at Gartner in charge of the automotive and mobility teams. And I'm really thrilled to be here talking with him again. Mike, welcome.
It's great to be here, Ed. Thanks for inviting me on.
So you work for Gartner, you're vice president there. Explain, you know, again, because these terms get thrown around a lot. And I think a lot of people don't even understand that there is a, when you say trough of disillusionment or peak hype, that you're referring to this specific cycle that Gartner uses to analyze technologies and where they are in adoption. So let's start with sort of where the cycle starts and just give people a sense of kind of what it looks like broadly, and then we'll zero in on the parts that we're trying to focus on today.
Yeah, basically, okay, the cycle is premised on this idea that expectations about a technology tend to be inflated, right? A lot earlier than their usefulness, right, or their commercialization. There's five parts to a hype cycle. The innovation trigger, this tends to be when we first really start hearing about a technology, when it's in the research phase, when there are really no real products, or if there are, they're kind of like beta products. Then you have the peak of inflated expectations, which basically most people call, you know, the peak of hype or hype peak or, you know, variations on that theme. This is usually when the media attention hits, when you really start to hear and everyone recognizes, gosh, this technology is really hyped. For things like autonomous vehicles, many of us probably remember the 2015, 2016 time period. That is, in fact, when it was at the peak of hype in our hype cycle. and when most of the money was really strongly pushed into the technology. That is followed by the best named part of the cycle, the trough of disillusionment. And there are many things that cause us to determine when a technology is hit there, but usually the most, the easiest one to see is when the news stories start to become negative, right? When people start to realize that this technology is really not fulfilling the expectations that some people had set in the near term. This period, the trough of disillusionment, your results may vary, but often it's the longest period, right? You know, not for every technology, but for many of them, this can stretch a long time. And interestingly, at the very bottom of the trough of disillusionment is when we tell clients, this is a really good time for you to invest in this technology. Okay, when it's at its very bottom, that usually means we're on the second or even third iteration of a technology, right? They're past the pilot stage or in version one, they're in version two or even version three. And some people are actually using the technology, but nobody is talking about it anymore. Or at least they're not talking about it in any way close to how they were talking about it when it was at the peak. Then kind of coming to what you were talking about, the slope of enlightenment. That is when technologies start to become useful, right? They have moved past the prototyping stage and now they're becoming useful. And finally, the plateau of productivity. This is kind of when we stop paying attention to a technology because it is being used everywhere and no one talks about it anymore. And by the way that the hype cycle shape works is that the expectations of a technology will never be even half as high as they were at the peak. Even when they're at the plateau of productivity, no one will expect much of the technology once it's really strongly being used in a market. And so that's really what the hype cycle is. And we find that even though we sometimes as analysts screw up about where we put a technology on this cycle, because we, you know, maybe thought it was at the peak and there was more to come or the technology changes, we usually get it close. I mean, I think that our track record is pretty solid in terms of determining when something's at the peak and when it is, you know, moving into sort of usefulness.
Which is why I think, you know, we more and more people are using these terms, as I think it is. It's a really useful way to think about this stuff. And I think one of the where the usefulness of this entire framework, for me at least, starts is something that seems obvious, but is actually quite a bit more profound, not to accidentally quote a leading technologist here, which is that this is about perception and not just reality, right? And I think this is the most important thing to understand for this whole conversation and really to keep in mind anytime you're talking about a new technology. If you're not working on it yourself, chances are you don't really know what's actually happening with the technology itself. And the public discourse, the conversation around it is something that is related to the reality, but it's going to be slightly different, right? And that's what you're discussing here is, in a way, it's you're measuring the perception and the beliefs around it, and to some extent, how much that perception varies from the reality. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the two axes are expectations over time, right? I mean, we think that this is useful mostly as a planning tool. One, well, actually, it's two uses. One, we give this to clients and they see a huge list of technologies on a topic. So we have one called the, you know, connected electric, you know, autonomous vehicle hype cycle. And not surprisingly, it's on those topics. Typically all the subjects are on there, but there's 30 different technologies or processes that are on there. And it gives people a good idea about what these technologies that are relevant are. But second, it shows them how close it is to being, you know, really relevant to their industry. So if they see something on the innovation trigger, then all that's for is R&D to pay attention that something like that is out there. Typically speaking, nobody's commercializing it. If it's at the peak of hype, you should, you know, proceed with caution. Everyone is excited about it, but we are also predicting that it's going to have a fall, right? And then in the trough, that's when we tell clients, hey, you know, so it's both a guide of what are the technologies we think are important but also a roadmap to when you should be investing in it and what part of your R&D stream should be focused on that.
Yeah, and if we've learned anything from the last decade plus, it's that those disconnects can be quite large. And yeah, certainly from an investment perspective, and again, whether that's investing in a company or as a company investing in certain kinds of R&D, understanding where those gaps are is huge. Personally, I remember, you know, taking my first autonomous vehicle ride or one of my first in 2016 from Waymo, and everyone thought this technology was right around the corner. You know, it was classic peak hype, and I rode in it. It was, of course, incredibly impressive, right? Like, there was nothing else like it at the time, hardly. But I was also like, this doesn't quite feel like it's right around the corner. And then three, you know, long but also short years later in 2019, I did that exact same route on Waymo. And it was night and day in terms of the performance. It was really getting to the point where it's close to what we see Waymo doing on the road today with real, you know, robotaxi service. But the perception had gone the opposite direction. And so it's just important for people, I think, to understand that, you know, technological development usually improves, right? But perceptions can be totally out of whack. As the technology is improving, the perception can be going the opposite direction.
That's absolutely true. In fact, I did a presentation a few years ago for Gartner that talked about how long after the initial Wright Brothers flight was the first semi-automated air flight. And it was like 10 years later. Mm-hmm. I mean, so within 10 years of the Wright Brothers taking off, there was some form of auto steering that was created. And now we're all the way up 100 years later, you have the Boeing issues with the Air Max and automating flights. We're not all the way there. And I'm not saying it's always going to be 100 years, but this is like a long process. And I definitely think that with especially the technology that we're hinting around, autonomous vehicles, this one is special in that it will be hard to ever get to the done point with this, right? Like, I think that we're going to be in various stages of, it's good enough to do this. Now it's good enough to do this with some reasonable reliability. I don't think that we can actually reach a point with this type of technology where we're finished.
Right. And that, right? So like all expectations kind of depend on what you think the goal is or what a reasonable goal is, right? And we've seen, so like Uber is like kind of a classic case of, you know, at the peak of hype, it was Uber is going to make private car ownership obsolete, right? Like that was the pitch. Like,
yeah,
you know, today by comparison to that standard, the fact that they've basically completely taken over the taxi business doesn't seem as impressive. It feels maybe disappointing,
yeah.
But that's still a huge shift that's happened, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think about that, mobility as a service or transportation network companies, as we would call companies like Uber, they're hand in glove with the hype around autonomous vehicles. That is what caused the hype boom, Travis Kalanick saying, hey, I'll buy 100,000 Teslas tomorrow if Elon can ship them to me. And that is what caused the flywheel effect of private equity firms valuing autonomous vehicle companies so highly. And it just went on and on from there, essentially, right? I mean, that is what caused it. And their premise was, we are going to change the way that we do transportation from asset ownership to essentially a transportation system where you pay by mile. Well, that only makes sense if the asset is incredibly expensive, like an airplane, right? Like, it's really, really, really hard to get people to leave their car, you know, if they can just park it in their driveway and there's cheap or relatively available parking everywhere. Why would you do it, even if the car was free and autonomous? So I think, anyway, without going too much into a tangent, those things went in tandem. And when it became clear that the business model for mobility as a service was mostly just a better way of ordering a cab, and that autonomy was not going to be able to displace that, then both of these technologies have settled into more of a realistic, you know, pathway for them.
Yeah. And let's actually look at mobility as a service before we get to the autonomous, because you're absolutely right. It was sort of the thing that really kicked off this whole flywheel of Silicon Valley investment in a lot of different kinds of mobility technologies. The idea of, you know, using your smartphone to move around was sort of the idea that Uber sort of took and turned into. And I love the Uber story because it really does, I think, show, you know, what a wild ride this hype cycle can be, right? Because if you think about it, and just sort of like talk us through, because, right, you know, Uber, it went from, you know, we're gonna make private car ownership obsolete. It went through this huge crushing cycle of disillusionment, but right, they managed to get public, and now they're starting to, you know, record quarterly profits. Yeah, so talk about a little bit about that. What are sort of that pattern show you about the hype cycle?
Well, okay, so I always use, I'm gonna talk about that one in a second, because that mobility services are climbing into the slope of enlightenment right now. But there's another technology I think that's really interesting to bring up that I think that people also grab onto, and I'll talk about mobility services in a second. But the peak of hype was reached for 3D printing in 2013. And some of you may remember 3D printing around 2013, 3DS, Stratasys, their stock values were through the roof. We were going to totally change manufacturing. Everything was going to be 3D printed. We were going to, everything was going to be disrupted in manufacturing using this technology. Then, you know, there was a massive investment. No one could figure out what to do with 3D printing. Okay. Like they couldn't figure out. It was neat. You know, I can print figurines for my Dungeons and Dragons campaign. I mean, it was not what people expected. It went all the way through the trough, and now it's on the slope of enlightenment. And do you hear about it? Not much, but it is actively in use in tons of manufacturing industries and actually starting to make a big impact. That is kind of the process that we are in. Mobility services may be a little bit faster than autonomy because we're talking about a digital service, right?
Yeah.
Let me
stop you really quick. Can you give a couple of examples of how 3D printing are actually being used in manufacturing today? Because I think they may be different. And I think this is an important piece of what you're talking about, is that, you know, once you get through the hype and the disillusionment, when you climb up that slope of enlightenment, the use cases that emerge there may actually be very, very different than the ones you were talking about and thinking about during the peak of hype. So tell us about that in manufacturing, because I think it's fascinating.
So the number one way that 3D printing, by the way, is extremely mature in one segment of the value chain, which is prototyping and development. But even that has gotten extremely advanced. So most car companies now have sand-casted printers where they can make molds to make exact, like really exotic and, cylinder heads, right? Or they can make molds to make really exotic, engine block designs, right? Or things that are very hard to do. That is extremely mature, very mature for prototyping and design and engineering development. Where now it is commonly used in manufacturing is to make tools and jigs in the plant. So tooling and the jigs that help set up things in manufacturing can be extremely expensive to make. And if they break, it takes forever to replace them. So now we commonly use across the automotive industry, but across general manufacturing, 3D printers to make these tools and jigs inside the plant that greatly speed up manufacturing. And now we're also seeing a number of manufacturers, usually smaller volume, use 3D printing even in vehicles for certain parts, right? So it might be parts that aren't available in one region. Maybe you have slightly different alterations to even engine parts. Some of the luxury manufacturers are using it to build parts of the powertrain. So it's not probably ever going to be a high volume manufacturing tool, but it is being used in end use manufacturing now to do customized work. It's been used for tools and jigs, and it's very mature and continuing to advance in prototyping and development. And car companies are actually not the best use case for it. Where it's really developed is in medical devices, you know, like individual medical devices, from teeth to hips to knees, prosthetics, it's being actively used. So this is where 3D printing really kicks butt. You have better scanning technology. You have better software and better printers. And you can now, for example, it's really difficult to do when you're doing a prosthetic. It's very difficult to get that knee or wherever the stump is, right, to get the sleeve that goes and connects to the prosthetic. Now they can do a quick scan on that, 3D print a cup for someone and send it to them. It used to cost $30,000. Now you can do it for, you know, nothing. Not nothing, but, you know, less than $1,000. So yeah, that's kind of where 3D printing is evolved.
And if you think about it, right, it's you know, and for making cars, you know, the way the car business works really is on scale. And if you think about making things at scale cheaply, you know, a big press that presses out the same piece over and over again is always going to be the cheapest way to do that kind of high scale manufacturing. So, but what you're saying is that this is the 3D printer technology is diffusing into those areas of the business where, you know, that the cost and scale is not so important, but it's that customization. It's getting things to fit for an individual customer at the high end of maybe the car market. Or again, I love that implant, you know, and prosthetics case, because every human body is different. You have to have that flexibility at the manufacturing level to make things sort of fit, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And what one of the things I was going to say is actually that you were touching on this, and I forgot to say what I'm saying is, it wasn't maybe the disrupting the manufacturing the way that people were thinking. And when we take it over to mobility or autonomy, it's where autonomy has quietly been very disruptive is across all the unsexy part of the value chain, right? Like, you know, we're seeing more autonomous lawnmowers and forklifts and, you know, things that are not on the road delivering people, but are getting more and more autonomous. So I don't know how many people have played around with like a DJI or a Skydio drone, but those things are incredible. Like in terms of their ability to essentially operate autonomously, that is all developed essentially with the same kinds of vision systems that were being developed for autonomous vehicles, and then as a side product, are now proliferating in other industries.
Right, right. So the hype around autonomous vehicle technology, right? It was the idea of a self-driving car, which is something, you know, since GM at the Motoramas in the 50s, you know, has been talking about. This is the next step of the car, and I think everyone heard self-driving car and thought, that's it, that's what it's going to be. Kind of like they heard, you know, the hype about 3D printing and thought, well, we're just gonna have printers that just print out a car body or something like that, right? And our minds kind of leap to these sort of like science fiction kind of tropes when we hear about these new technologies. But as time goes on, as you say, just as in 3D printing, with autonomy, you know, the self-driving car, I mean, we've seen this headline, the self-driving car is for all intents and purposes dead in terms of, you know, in the near term, in terms of a car that you're gonna buy and own and it's gonna drive you where you wanna go. But we have robo-taxis, although maybe those a little earlier in the hype cycle, but let's compare where are robo-taxis sort of now versus, as you say, like agriculture, logging, mining, some of these other off-road applications where autonomous vehicle technology, in the case of mining trucks, right? Caterpillar's had those on the, hauling mining materials, what's it, for a decade now?
Yeah, more than a decade. You know, okay, so just to be specific, we have multiple. Here's how Gartner cheats, right? So we have a main, what we call innovation profile. That's the dot on the hype cycle for autonomous vehicles. And that really collects everything together. That's not just robocabs. It's really all autonomous vehicles. Where it is on the hype cycle right now is actually not only, it's past the bottom of the trough of disillusion. I mean, it's not on the slope of enlightenment yet, but it's getting close, okay? We actually think it'll be fewer than 10 years until it hits the plateau of productivity for that point. And this is a result of a couple things. One, yes, you're right. From a robocab perspective, there's been a lot of consolidation and cutting back. But from a execution standpoint, the technology is getting really good. And Waymo's going to the highways. They've got a huge volume of experience already, and they're starting to be able to proliferate to other cities, right? They're going to start to move. So it's slow and agonizing, but it's getting a lot closer to real life. And they're the leader, right? So they're clearly the leader in this space. Everything else, when it comes to agriculture or drones You are already seeing a lot of active autonomy in use now, because what those things have is they have very simple design domains, and that what that means is you can put the equipment on the vehicles very inexpensively. So the cost to produce the equipment is very low, and the danger for operation is very low, and the regulation is very low, and you know, so you put all that together, and obviously you are going to have a lot more opportunity. We've actually seen, just as a funny story, I had I can't, because these are clients, I'm not allowed to name names, but in the last couple of years, I actually had worked with a group that was trying to run a group of autonomous construction equipment on the side of a mountain in South America, where they were going to have all autonomous equipment working on the side of the mountain because they didn't want to put any humans in the situation. That is exactly the application where we're starting to see these things. Before, people would have said, no, too hard. Now they can actually do it. You know, they can actually rig out mining trucks, diggers, you know, all the cool stuff, stick them on the side of a mountain to dig a roadway, basically, and remotely either operate them or monitor them. So that's happening now.
Yeah. And you know, that also, I mean, it brings up a kind of an old saying about sort of rule of thumb about robotics and automation, which is, right, like, was it dirty, dangerous? I think there might be another one in there, right? Which is that there are some jobs where, you know, mining certain kinds of material, well, we need those materials. Someone has to go do them, but they're dirty jobs. They're dangerous jobs. They're places, you know, if you think about in a factory, right, the most automated part of a car factory is where all the welding, the body shop, right, where all that welding takes place. And so to some extent, it's this moving up the slope of enlightenment. It's about getting over all of the sort of, all the excitement about what all it can do, what is possible. And instead be like, well, okay, where does it make the most sense, right?
It is. And actually, though, but everyone has to be thankful for the hype, because how should I say this? All the cool stuff, it's unlikely we would move it and have as many breakthroughs happen if we didn't pour so much money down the drain on over-enthusiastic investment in a technology that's not going to really pay off for a while, right? I mean, we did several things with our billions and billions and billions of dollars of investment in autonomy. One of them is we created a huge cadre of new scientists who understand this technology. We also advanced the state of the art of vision systems and LiDAR systems dramatically. We figured out how to put in what in Gartner we would call edge AI at the in the most advanced instance. Really, an autonomous vehicle is the most advanced instance of edge artificial intelligence that we have out there, meaning it's not going back to the cloud to make a decision. It's got to make it right there in the car, right? And all those things have advanced dramatically because of the, whatever, $200 billion that have been invested in autonomous vehicles. Unfortunately, a lot of those investors aren't going to get reap the rewards of that investment right now. That's the truth.
And that's one of the challenges, right? As an investor, obviously, in particular, you think about, you know, you invest in companies. You don't invest in technologies. You invest in companies. And ideally, you're investing in a company that you think has the best shot at turning that technology into a business. But I think, you know, one of the things that gets lost in these cycles of you know, the disillusionment part of this cycle is, you know, you see the companies go bankrupt, right? Some of these startups that are all, every startup is risky, right? But they start to go bankrupt, and people associate the failure of the company with the failure of the technology. And I think that understanding the difference, why? So, you know, how do you think about that? What do you tell investors?
Part of the cycle, part of the hype cycle is the in the peak of hype, proliferation of companies or vendors, as we would call them, and heavy investment by venture and other capital. And then for the trough of disillusionment, it's consolidation, right? It's consolidation of all those companies. So to get to one, you need proliferation. And then two, you have to get consolidation. And then what we see with the slope of enlightenment is basically, after you cleaned out the suckers, so to speak, the poor guys who don't make it, the ones who make it to version 2 and 3 of the technology, those are, I don't want to say they're your winners, but they're your competitors. right? They're going to make the market that exists after you get past that point. And so when you see companies bowing out at this late stage, you do kind of wonder, did they bow out, you know, right when they were going to be close to success? Or did they make the right decision because they have no idea how much more money they're going to have to invest before they get to that point where it can be commercialized? And I'm not blaming anybody who said, we're not doing this, because there's some indication around autonomy. And I would say it is, can you really have a differentiated experience with this, right? Like, it works. Okay, do I need to have five vendors or even three vendors for this? You know, like, I just need something that works.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because, you know, when you think about the venture capital sort of culture in Silicon Valley, it's almost like Hollywood or something. It's all about excitement and hype and this kind of group dynamics. But what you're describing here is sort of like, right, it's that classic Warren Buffettism of when everyone is greedy, be fearful. And when everyone is fearful, be greedy. I mean, that's really what you're talking about here, right?
100%. That is exactly right. And I think that, it's interesting because let's swirl back to mobility as a service. Those guys had a huge benefit. Lyft, we'll call it Uber and Lyft, you know, at least in our market. And what was that huge benefit? Because of the network requirement to be able to make that business model even sort of function, it kept competition reasonably low. There were lots of little guys that popped up here and there trying to compete, but you had to have the app. And, you know, like you had to be on everybody's phone in order for you to even compete, right? And there's really now only two effectively left in the US. And there may be some little guys here and there, but we have two companies left. So those guys who are making it, they don't have much competition. Right? I mean, and so they've been able to change their business model without losing all their customer base because there's just no competition. In autonomy, now, you know, we're shrinking down to the point where it's going to start to be a little bit easier for Waymo to do what it needs to do to actually make money with this. Although I will say, just as an addendum, I still question whether Google will run this, like, will want to be a cab company in the future. I mean, it seems to me like their business model is going to be licensing the technology and selling cloud services or something to, you know, to whoever runs those cabs. But
yeah, no. So, and let's I think the autonomous vehicle one is such an interesting point right now. I know, and I don't want to put you on the spot because I know Gartner's in the middle of updating the hype cycle like you do every year, and so by the time this comes out, you'll be in the middle of that work. But you know, Waymo is so you know, I know you've ridden in San Francisco. It's just an absolutely unbelievable experience. It's night and day from even a year or two ago where this technology was, but it's still in that gap between. The technology really works, but like it's not making money yet. Is that what the slope of enlightenment is all about?
It is. In fact, to be truthful, most technologies and most vendors, by the time they get to the slope of enlightenment, are profitable, right? Like they're making money. I'm going to put this in the autonomy is such a hard technology. It's such a huge advancement that it kind of exists in a different region of the universe than every other technology, right? I have always personally said, now this is me as an analyst, that there was too much of an assumption always made about the business model for autonomy. Like that people would say, hey, if we just drive these cars around all the time, we're going to make so much money, it doesn't even matter how much the car costs. And that was an extreme simplification of the reality of operating an incredibly complex vehicle, which only a PhD can repair with parts that are not off the shelf, you know, like, so I think that it will be extremely difficult, no matter how good the technology is, for people to operationalize this technology for probably the next 10 to 15 years in real terms, just because nothing on those things right now as a standard component, and no one knows how to fix any of it unless you are like working with this very closely. So it will be really hard to overcome those operational challenges, no matter how good Waymo gets the vehicle, period.
Yeah.
Right.
It'll
be extremely hard.
So the self-driving car is out of reach. The robo-taxi as a profitable service is a stretch goal that I think probably only a company with the resources and the experience that a Waymo has even has a shot at getting at. But in the meantime, as you said, we have this huge tech dividend that all of this investment has created. And now it's a question of how do we, you know, continue to bend the cost curve on LiDAR so we can make AEB work at night with pedestrians? Or, you know, how do we plug this technology into mining, into agriculture, into all these other use cases where you don't have the same sort of safety standard that you have of a taxi riding on the open street, and all of these use cases, right? That is what this slope of enlightenment looks like, right?
100%. Yeah. And really, I do think that this is, we're right now, it's so interesting. And I know I don't want to hijack it with the current buzz word of the universe, but what is happening right now, or what happened last summer with Gen AI, or last year with Gen AI, reminds me so much of autonomous vehicles, right? We are seeing absolutely crazy valuations. We're seeing new vendors pop up every 5 minutes. You know, ChatGPT and Gemini are going to disrupt absolutely everything. No one's going to have to write code anymore. All of journalism's going out of business. You know, like, every hyperbolic statement that you could possibly imagine is being made about generative AI, okay? However, what I fully expect is over the next 3 or 4 years, it may move faster because this is a digital technology. You don't have to stick anyone in a physical vehicle and make sure that they don't die. But what I expect is that over the next 3 or 4 years, you will find that it makes a big impact, but it's going to be all in these little things, not the big thing, right? We're not headed towards, you know, some conscious AI that can do anything. We're headed towards a bunch of little tools that are proliferated throughout the ecosystem. And that is basically what's happened with autonomy. We're seeing driver assistance systems get better and better. The price point's going to come way down. You'll likely start to see, you know, much better versions of autonomous tractors and diggers and all of the very inexpensive vision systems that have now been developed for these vehicles. Very effective, very inexpensive vision systems are going to start to show up in simple applications. Very, you know, I think that that's the way that this has worked already. And certainly is what I expect to happen. And I also think that whether it's fully safe or not, you're clearly already seeing big advances from the automakers on putting driver assistance systems in vehicles and edging towards autonomy, sometimes in scary ways, but also in impressive ways as well.
Absolutely. Well, that's just about time, all the time we have for now, unfortunately. But luckily, there will be a new Gartner Hype Cycle coming out this year, as there is every year. So we'll have to have you back to talk about sort of how you've updated it for this year, because I think this is just such a fascinating topic. And I think, you know, as you highlighted, it's really an important one for anybody who's interested in this space, because as you say, when the hype is out of control, you know, you're just bombarded by all this news and headlines. And I think it's when the really interesting stuff, this is the paradox, I think, of our online age. So when the interesting stuff really starts to happen, there's less media attention, there's less hype around it. You really kind of have to go out and find it. That for me is why I, you know, really appreciate having folks like you that I can talk to, hopefully others that we have on this podcast and ultimately hopefully in our conference. So Mike Ramsey, Vice President at Gartner, thank you so much for making the time today to chat with us.
Thanks, Ed. It was awesome.